listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only, yes, he's back, Bobby Summerfield.
Yes, my guy!
Lovely to be back with you lads.
Hey,
and lesses.
This is show number 108. This is Bobby's 32nd show.
nice.
I just thought it was the blog version of Bobby.
We exchange one Englishman for another. Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, they're the same person. People don't know that. But
hello, Mike.
Bobby, it's good to see you, bro.
You too, bud. Nice to see you, matey.
And next to him, we've got Scott Gershon. Scott!
Hello! Hey!
And next to him, we've got Brandon Murtai. Brandon.
What's up, Mike?
Brandon! It's good to see you, Brandon. Next to Brandon, we've got the talker, as we call him, Hezekiah
the face of the podcast. Only.
And finally, over here on my left, we've got the one and only Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, Rob Arbatier.
Hello there. Hello, everyone.
Good evening. Good to see you, Rob.
Good evening.
Good to be seen.
And then joining us is our good friend, Michael Bard from Studio Bard.
Michael. All right, Michael.
So nice to be back.
Mikey.
And you know what? You know Rob's working on some cool stuff when Michael's in town.
I wish Michael was in town more.
I like his comedy routine.
But it is true. We're working on some cool stuff, some of which we can talk about.
But great. So it's great to have you back here.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Today on the show, we're going to talk a lot about a lot of different things. We're going to touch a little bit on Spotify. We're going to touch a little bit about creating your workspace, a little bit on the copyright, and then the second half we're going to talk about mixing and what kind of mixer you are and, you know, why people mix the way they do. But the first thing I wanted to start off with is this past weekend I took a trip up to the Bay Area, and I don't know about you guys, but I have always been reluctant to use subscription-based. Today I'm going to have a hard time talking. Last time it was names. Jay-Z, David Z.
Right, right, yes.
But,
we learned that lesson.
Subscription-based music services that are out there. I've always wanted to own my music. I've always had this big thing about buying music. And I just recently upgraded from the free Spotify to premium. And let me tell you, I am sold on Spotify. Mm-hmm. For $10 a month, the premium service is pretty awesome. The selection was really great. There's certain things that you can't get, like the Beatles and even like Peter Gabriel, some of his stuff. But the cool thing is the way it integrates with your iTunes library and then the Spotify app on your phone. And the offline listening is phenomenal. Before I left on my trip, I created a playlist on my computer of songs that I wanted to hear. And I, you know, since you have this massive library, I was listening, pulling just obscure albums, you know, and making a playlist for them. Once I did that, I fired up my phone in the car and I just checked make available offline. And as I was driving, apparently it was downloading because it never broke the stream the whole time. And I went, you know, through the grapevine. And it was just awesome just to have all this music that I was like a kid in the candy store, that I could just have my pick of anything I wanted. And I created these great playlists. And there's no pressure to own this stuff. And I could listen to things that I wouldn't normally listen to. And it was really amazing. I had a brand new respect for the whole subscription-based model. And I can see how it can work. The only thing that concerns me is if it's, you know, I'd like the artists to be able to make some money off this, you know, obviously, because as it gets more and more popular, if you ever seen a royalty check from a record company on a song that's, you know, not that popular. I mean, it's like 87 cents, you know. Uh-huh.
Did it download via 3G? Is that how it was streaming down?
You know what?
It does.
I,
So Verizon or AT&T makes money streaming. They sell. Everybody makes money on the music except for the composers.
My understanding was that the big music companies had made blanket deals with Spotify, with their are other subscription services, and then somehow they track usage and
like radio. It's like old time radio plays and things like that. And the cool thing is if you have Shazam and Spotify on your iPhone, that is a killer 1-2 punch. Because if you hear a song, you're like, what song is that? You Shazam it, it identifies it, and then you go to Spotify, you enter it in, and you just don't get that song, you get the whole freaking album that came off of. Oh, I'm going to listen to that whole thing. It's really liberating. It's just a cool way to listen to music and to have music all the time. And the fact that it syncs up, like, your playlist, you can do a lot of this on the computer, and then, next time you fire up your iPhone, boom, there's your playlist right there. And I know Bobby, you've been using it for a while.
Because it was used to have it in England, and it hasn't been here. I've always had an English account, in fact. But just when it's come out now, I've gone to get the American account. But yeah, it's the best way. It's the way to have music. You don't actually buy it. You just buy the license to listen to anything you want to listen to ever.
Right.
And you can make your own playlist exactly as you say. You can download them. And you can rip them as well if you want to be naughty, but you can. Obviously, people do.
Oh, great.
I mean, DJs do that. DJs want to have their own thing at night and we go to the club. So they do a rip. Get a bunch of stuff down.
Well, there are other subscription services that have the same model.
Right.
I know that
Rhapsody.
Rhapsody. Is it Cricket? The phone company has a thing called Move Music that operates very much the same way. It's in the cloud, but if you need it locally, it comes locally.
The question is, who's got access to the best libraries of music?
The cool thing I like about Spotify,
It
works good, and it also works with my iTunes library, which is really nice because it pulls some stuff out of my iTunes and it pulls some stuff. And when you get a premium account, the streaming's at 320 as opposed to 128 or 64, which makes all the difference in the world.
And no ads.
no ads.
And how much was that?
It's $10.
Oh, $10 a month?
I mean, that's like, I spend way more than that on music right now.
Sure.
So it's like
getting back to what you brought up earlier, I mean, I've heard people say that it's the absolute death knell of the music industry. That, that artists just, how could you possibly hope to get the kind of royalties you would get if people were buying this stuff? I don't know what the actual business arrangement is, but...
But, I was thinking about that, too. And it's kind of like what they were saying about radio. And it's, it just gets back to, old things become new again. It's just that same old cycle.
Except the difference is with radio, you'd have to wait for your song to come around.
Right.
This is very different from radio. This is just like...
Radio on demand.
But
radio
on demand. Here's the thing about it, though, is, if you're an independent artist, you don't have to make a deal with Spotify. Like, I was looking up, for instance, Martin, and his independent records aren't on Spotify, but his label one is on Spotify. So it's kind of cool because there's no reason why you don't have to license it. And if you gain a following and you want to continue to sell it over on iTunes, it'll work. It'll show up in the Spotify playlist. So anything you buy off iTunes shows up inside. I just think it's kind of a really good win-win
Spotify,
situation.
It does have an amazing database, though. It does have an amazing catalog, rather.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's
a lot of stuff.
Like I said, some of them were surprised me though because Peter Gabriel is really thin. But I was looking for obscure bands and just old stuff, that I used to listen to as a kid, and it was all there. And then I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing. So.
Does it have the new stuff too?
What?
Does Spotify have all the new stuff?
Yeah, I listen to the. funny enough, I listen to the new Jay-Z Kanye album on using Spotify. Stuff that, I wouldn't necessarily buy or not buy, but you want to listen to it. And as someone who makes music and mixes and things like that, man, the more you can listen, the more you can hear just things that you would just not ever think of doing before, and you don't have to get dinged for it. It's pretty awesome. I'm definitely a believer in this subscription. I don't know what the long-term effects are, but it's coming. This is something
we're not going to stop it, so.
Right, you're not so.
And on the other, let's go ahead.
Sorry.
On the other hand, there is money changing hands, so it's sort of the next step
you know, in abolishing the whole idea of people just stealing the crap. Right?
Right, exactly. If you think about the people, a lot of music is not getting paid for these days. And, of course, you can't always get good quality music or consistent quality music, meaning same sample rates and with the art and the information about the bands. But with at least this, you know, if say, the world, or at least 30% of the world actually started part of the subscription. That's a lot of money. $10 a month from everybody in the world. I mean, not everybody. I mean, like, 40% of the people that listen to music. I think music money would actually trickle down to the players and writers of the music and producers more than is happening now. So I do think it's a good idea. And if you think about it, it's the best model, the simplest model, always the easiest thing in the world gets assimilated, taken in. Like MP3s, much easier to use than high frequency sample stuff. So if it's so easy for people to listen to anything they like and it costs $10, with more people doing it, maybe it'll come down to $7.99 a month or something like that.
But you know what happens? I remember
that's a lot of money. It's a really lot of money.
I remember years ago when the cable first came out and it was normal TV, and we sat with investors and the whole thing. What they said is, look, we're going to come in like $30 a month. It's only $30 a month. But they actually had it planned out that every 2 years they'd increase it. And once they got dominant, so if you get a handful of companies, like it's almost like what iPod is.
Right.
Yeah.
When it becomes a handful of major networks, distributors of music, and people get used to it, and they give it $10 for free, then they just start, it's only 50 cents more. Is 50 cents going to break you that month? Then the next month, it's only $1 more. Right. It's less than a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And little by little, next thing you know, it's $25.
Right. And in the meantime, the whole traditional way of marketing and selling music has died away because there's been no. Yeah.
Although I think what's going to happen is you're going to see, since it's only a monthly, you know, you're paying month to month. If another service starts up, which it absolutely can, all they need to do is just make a license deal with the record labels.
Yeah. But if you have big enough subscription, you can play hardball, saying like, look, we're the big three. You can't sell it to those guys. We want exclusive deals. And all of a sudden, because look, we've got 10 million listeners, and all of a sudden, you don't want to piss them off.
No, there's definitely that. But at the same time, what are the consequences if you do piss them off? It's not like if I'm a record label, if I'm Sony and somebody else wants the license and someone's trying to strong arm me, hey, I've got the content. And usually content is king, you know, because there's going to be another pipeway opening up. Wait till, you know, Apple's going to get in there somewhere. There's going to be some type of subscription because it just makes too much sense. And I think that's going to be a great thing because, you know, I was telling Bobby, one of the things that I didn't like about subscription services was the fact that, you know, in 25 years, what's my kid going to find in the shoebox? Where is she going to be able to, like, hey, what was my dad listening to back in that podcast thingy days that he used to do? And, of course, we'd still be podcasting then, but
I'll be on podcast 39.
Man, we missed you, Bobby. but you know, how's my daughter going to find what I was listening to? And then it kind of dawned on me. And you know what it's going to be? It's not going to be the music. It's going to be the playlists. Like, I'll keep my playlists and I'll keep them, you know, I'm going to arrange them and I'm going to keep them organized.
So that's what Google is into, is socialized playlists.
Yeah.
And Facebook's been talking a lot about that.
Yeah, and
where it's like, hey, not only can you exchange information with your friends, but you could start seeing, hey, there's their playlist, there's their photos, here's their favorite restaurants. Yeah. And as you go, you can start exchanging.
But even if you don't want to share it, because I don't want to share it, but I want to have a copy of it, she's going to be able to come look at my playlist and not hear some old, obsolete format that she probably won't be able to find a player for. No, she's going to be actually hear the same files because those files are just still going to be around.
That's funny because my son just turned 21, and he's recently been like doing a lot of DJ kind of stuff.
Right.
And last week he stumbled over my record collection in the basement, which is where it is. I mean, I have turntables everywhere, but I haven't really put needle to vinyl in a long time. And he just went nuts.
Yeah.
He said, Dad, can I have your records?
Yeah.
No.
You can sample them.
But you know, but I just think, you know, that whole the whole legacy of your music, they're going to be able to experience it in a level that we haven't been able to experience it. Because I was talking to a friend of mine, and she has a ton of cassettes. I mean, her kids are not going to be able to play a cassette, because cassettes is just – it's a format that is just almost dead. I mean, if you can find a tape recorder now, that's just – that's so rare. And
I've still got a Walkman.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in 10, 15 years, it's going to be as obsolete as an 8-track, you know. I mean, there'll be, you know, somewhere in a museum there'll be one, but – and think how huge cassettes were. Cassettes were giant. And so it stops having all these format, you know, problems. And I just think the subscription model, I found something that works, and I'm sold. Are you guys – any of you guys sold yet? Are you still kind of – Rob, what about you?
No, I mean – not really, only because unless they have truly everything, like to say, you know, I happen to really like the Beatles, so to say I wouldn't have the Beatles or wouldn't have all of Peter Gabriel, to me that's, you know,
they –
we're not
have
talking
a lot,
about...
Though. They have a really lot. Well,
they do have a lot, but the thing is, it's not that expensive to just be able to buy, you know, to be able to get anything. I mean, and I like having the stuff locally. If I'm someplace where I'm out of touch, I like to know that I have my own files. I mean, I'm an old guy, so
yeah,
I
but
like
you
having
know
the files.
You can make them available for you offline. That's the thing. And there's no
right,
pressure.
But if I wanted to mix a bunch of, just for the sake of this conversation, Beatles and Peter Gabriel stuff right in there,
absolutely, you can do it. If Spotify has it, it'll show up. If you have it, it'll show up. That's what's so great about it is you can mix. You can mix your own library with what Spotify offers.
It wasn't quite clear when you said that. It's essentially what it does, Spotify, once it's installed on your computer, it looks at your music folder. If you have iTunes or some other application, mostly iTunes people have, it says, okay, here's your local files, and it makes them that they're available in the list. So when you drop down, you dial in Peter Gabriel. If you have Peter Gabriel on your own local hard drive, it will show up, and it integrates
right.
Well.
It aggregates your music with the music.
Yes, exactly.
Right. The music that's either in the cloud or the music that you've downloaded right from the cloud. And again, you know, we keep saying Spotify. I'm a non-premium customer, but I'm trying out all these different
right
services, because I think it has a lot to do with catalog and availability. It also has a lot to do with, you know, with the user interface part of it. Spotify has figured out this whole iTunes integration thing, which is cool.
So it's a music librarian system for your own personal stuff.
Right.
As well.
That's great.
As well. Yeah.
As well.
Do you guys know, does it only look at your library to see what has been downloaded from iTunes or a legit site like that? What if you have stuff that just –
if you ripped it –
ripped off of CDs, it'll recognize all
you
that
stuff?
You
can ask it to look for files. But
okay,
if it's put in a certain look for folder, you know, you can ask it to look in this shared folder.
Yeah, yeah.
You can exclude folders.
And if you nice ripped it in iTunes, it'll show up just
yeah,
like,
straight away.
Right.
So
yeah,
if you have CDs that you stick into your computer and rip it into whatever iTunes, let's just say,
it'll notice it.
It will look at it.
That's pretty
good.
And you know,
and also update, by the way. Sorry, it goes and gets the metadata if you don't have. If
oh,
you
really?
Don't have, yeah, it also does marry, like puts the pictures with. If you don't have a fully integrated, you know, sometimes you rip a CD and you don't get the artwork, obviously.
Right.
But sometimes it goes and gets the names for you, so it will do that, and it makes it really – it's really well done.
That's useful.
Yeah, it's really cool. And like I said, if you get the premium and you have it available on your phone, there's no pressure to like, oh my gosh, I have to back up this because it might, you know, something might happen, you know. I mean, I have my iTunes library backed up like 4 times. I've got Time Machine, and I've dragged it over into 2 different hard drives. I mean, I'm really, you know, protected over that. And now I don't feel that pressure, even with my iTunes library, because if I made a playlist and it had a song that was on my iTunes library, but it wasn't on my iPhone, but it streamed that song, which was just brilliant. I'm just thinking, this is just smart. Anyhow, I just wanted to put my 2 cents in on that. And because of that, I've got an invite. So if you're a listener out there, the first one that sends me an email to audio@nowcastnetwork.com, I will send you an invite to Spotify, and you can try it out yourself. I don't know how many invites I have, but they said I had at least one. So so send me an email. Okay, now moving on from that, speaking of sending emails, this has nothing to do with that. But
how's that for a segue?
Sorry, I'm reading my notes at the same time. I'm like, there is no smooth way this is going to happen. So we're just going to stop and change the topics. So, Bobby Somerville.
Hello, sir.
Bobby actually recently just came out of the, I don't know, your
dungeon.
Dungeon that you've been in. And we had a nice long talk about studios and spaces and setting things up. And I know you wanted to say a few things about making sure it's right, because why don't you tell what you just experienced?
Well, I've been missing for a couple of months. I'm not because I'm a lazy sod, but partly because I've had a pinched nerve in my neck at C7. No big deal. That's like common sort of stuff. But what caused it was I've got a bone spur, and it's been caused by bad posture, and that's been enhanced or more accelerated by a way of working. And I've worked obviously in the studios, as we all have, hunched and crunched over, you know, in front of monitors or keyboards or mixing desks or whatever it is for 30 years now. And basically what we forget to do is we sit there for 18 hours a day and we don't necessarily move around a lot, or we just sit through a cramp in the neck and say, oh, I just got to do this edit. Oh, I've got to do this. A client's come in. So we panic our way through, you know, work, and we work in compromised situations for our body, for our frame. So me being not really into the whole ergonomic thing, I was kind of new to the whole, I understand, you know, understood a little bit about it. But anyway, long story short, I had a guy come up after laughing for about 10 minutes at the way I worked. He said, you know, how long have you been working like this? And I told him about 25 years. And he gave me some pointers and told me how humans of my size, and we all live individual sizes, of course, how you should measure yourself and how we should be working in a certain, like an office situation, like an office worker, because office workers work, you know, obviously typing all day long, data entering. And that's essentially what we're doing, if you think about it. We're mousing around and clicking musical buttons, but essentially we are putting data into computers a lot of the times. And also on an analog mixer, you're hunching over the sliders and everything. So anyway, the long story is I learned that I've been sitting and with a bad posture for a long time. And as you guys can see me, nobody can see me on the podcast, but my neck's pretty stiff and I can't really look left right now. But hopefully it's going to come right in a couple of months if all goes well. But I thought I'd just share the idea with people that if you are working and you're sitting in a cramped situation, there is lots of information online with office ergonomics that I think it's highly worth looking at, because what you'll most probably see is that a lot of you are working badly and you may be young enough to work through it right now, which I did for 20 years. But as you get older, your bones start getting bone spurs and the other kinds of things, and you start to get really sore. So much so that I have not been able to work in my studio for about 7 weeks now, because I can't sit down for more than, like, I'm wiggling around here now.
Well, did you notice everybody started sitting up straight? you'll actually hear it. Everybody's sitting up straight.
So it's worthy of it. Anyway, so do yourself a favor. And I'm not saying this is the best company, but where I bought all my stuff from was a company called Human Scale. They're worthy of checking out because they've got a lot of good information of how we should sit and everything. And there are also a lot of websites free. Just go online and check out ergonomics and the way to sit. But long story short is I made a work table where I have a music keyboard, a weighted piano kind of keyboard, where I, you know, play notes into to a computer to record. But when I'm not using it, it's on metal scale rails, and I can magically make it slide away. And the keyboards that I would normally, the QWERTY keyboards and the controllers and the MIDI controllers, and they slide down into a better position. Oh. Also, I have a keyboard that comes up from underneath. A QWERTY keyboard, that comes up from underneath the music keyboard, so it's always at arm height. I have arm rests, and I have three monitor stands that have 30-inch range, so I can actually position my monitors literally like 23 inches down, and I can sit and work looking down in the perfect situation the time. So it's pretty cool, and I bought a good Human Scale chair.
That's a big change.
Now, what about tendonitis for the arm with the mousing?
Okay, so the best way to mouse is to actually mouse.
Get it down.
Yeah, no, actually, 90 degrees is good, but the ideal way to data entry on a keyboard and a mouse is like this. Hands are straight.
This is an audio podcast.
Yeah, you have to describe it.
Yes, exactly. It's not a video podcast. So basically, my arms were 90 degrees to the floor, but your hand should be at the straight with your arm. So there's no pressure on your arm tendons, which causes carpal tunnel. So when you have a mouse that's higher up and you mouse with your hand at a 45 degree angle, that's really bad. It doesn't take long for it to start damaging. Strange thing is, many years ago, I had I've got a big old scar in my right shoulder, about 7 inches. I had this like growth in my right arm and I couldn't move it anymore.
There's a mouse?
Seriously, I went to the UCLA and the guy's like, I don't know what you've done to your shoulder. What do? You play baseball? I said, no, I don't. He said, what do? And I said, I've been mousing. And I'd been mousing for years with my mouse at a reach, an arm's reach out of long, you know, wrong, basically. Right. And it formed a growth. And the guy said, yeah, you do that long enough, your body just says, that's scar tissue. Here you go. But so bad, I couldn't even lift my arm up.
It's like your body saying, just, get me out of here.
Saying, stop. So anyway, so I thought I'd share that with you. Ergonomics for musicians and mixers and producers, big time.
You know, speaking of ergonomics, Brandon, you got rid of your chair. You've got it.
Yes, I recently got rid of my chair and got one of those balls, exercise balls.
Yeah.
And sitting on that. And it's been good.
It doesn't give you your back, allow you to sit back, though.
No, you sort of have to, you know, sit. It forces you to sit in good posture and stay up straight. But, you know, it's good for a while. Towards the end of the day, sometimes I'm like, oh, where's my chair? You know, so it's good. Maybe keep your chair on hand. Don't get rid of it like I did.
But the cool thing is those balls, they have chair fittings that go with them. So
they do. That would be a great invention.
Yeah, it's a steel frame on wheels that take different size balls, and you put your ball in the middle of it. The balls that just sit on. Yes.
Suddenly we've got a junior high.
Awesome. Check it out. It's pretty cool.
I will.
Okay, pretty one cool. more time. What?
So these exercise balls, they're physio balls, they're called, right. and they're really useful, and they're great for sitting on because they have to keep your core. You know, your core is the only part that keeps your spine strong. Anyway, so these things, as Brandon was saying, when he sits on the thing after a couple of hours, I have one too, your butt starts to get sore and your back hurts and you start getting ill. And you wish you had a chair to lean against and slouch on, but you can't. But with this new little contraption they make, it's sort of like a steel frame, a hollow steel frame with a back on it that is on wheels, and you get them at different sizes, and you get one of these physio balls and you place it in the middle of it, and you can literally roll around the room on your physio ball and have a back chair on it. So that's pretty cool.
I think you should be strapped up straight.
Hang on a second. Now I said, get your balls.
Have little optic nerves and little, you know.
But there is a lot of stuff online, as I say. And if you go and have a look at images, there is one or two German companies that make these super high tech editing things.
Right.
And the chair literally reclines like a jet engine, a jet pilot thing. And the guy's like with his. I think it's called a zero gravity chair.
Right.
And that monitors, he's got like monitors and audio monitors in the air, like 60 degrees facing down to me. It looks like a space cadet. Pretty cool.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. Your workspace is such a personal place. I mean, it's. I was
you mean
talking,
mine personally or just no?
Anyway. No, but really, because that's one place where I spend as much as I can to make it perfect for me, because it's more than just a place you work. It's your refuge. It's the place a lot of times
you spend most of your life.
Yeah, and it's also a place where there's a lot of a comfort, man. I can't tell you when things go bad, there's nothing better than to me coming to my little studio West Wave, just locking the door and then just doing my own thing in my own space and just forgetting everything that's out there. And when you don't have it, it's traumatic, and Michael and Rob are both going through a little bit of that. Michael just finished going through that through your studio transformation.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I moved. The last time I was here, I was in the midst of moving out of my commercial building, and putting my studio back in my house after 25 years.
Right.
And there was a lot of trepidation, because I was used to having a business space where people come in and it's your business. It's not your house. Well, I started to realize that 90% or more of my work, there were no people. It was just me.
Right.
Right? There were no... The clients have disappeared. They send you the stuff and you do the work, and I don't know how it is for you, Scotty, but... Mm-hmm. And then there's playback.
I got a big credenza in the back of my room for clients. Uh-huh. It makes a great flat spot to put all my stuff on.
Yeah. Well, mine used to be the same way. Yeah. Anyway, so... But I have now spent the last... I'm just about done. Spent the last almost 8 months building a new studio. And in the interim, I had a temporary, temporary control room set up in my den.
Right.
And it's just, it's really, you're absolutely right. It's really tough to not have a space that feels like it's dialed in and settled and has the right vibe and, you know, comfort level for you. And, you know when you go in there and you flip a knob, something is going to happen that you want to happen. and there's not a bunch, you know, it's clean, right. And you know, all those things.
And you know, it doesn't have to be like a studio. I mean, we're fortunate here, a lot of the guys, to have our own places. But I remember, you know, growing up, and I like just having my little corner, just my little section of my room that I could just sit down, and that would be my place where I can create
a little
stuff
refuge.
Like that.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's so important. So don't think, you know, when we're talking about this, that you have to have, you know, an elaborate setup. It could just be, you know, the little desk that you have where you write your music. But whatever it is, you know, that becomes
your
precious.
Safe zone.
That's your safe zone. And and what Bobby was saying is, you know, set it up right so that it doesn't, you know, end up biting you in the back.
Really, yeah. And for younger people mostly, because I remember I was, you know, obviously going, this is fine. I know ergonomics. But really, it kicks your butt as you get older. You go, man, my back hurts now. Oh, my neck hurts. Oh, my arm hurts. Oh, my elbow's sore. And you think, well, why am I hurting myself?
But, yeah, I mean, I know if you look at, like, well, Rob, I mean, you're in the midst of upgrading.
In the midst of a remodel, you'll say. Yes, we're doing a bunch of repairs because my studio got damaged in a flood, which is a long story. But, yeah, we're being forced to sort of figure out a way to work in one room while the next room is being completely demolished and rebuilt, and it's a little bit tricky.
So if you want any jackhammering for drums,
we got it. But it is an upheaval because I'm used to that being my sort of sanctuary space where I can go and be creative and do things, and
right.
Now it's a little bit tricky. And Michael and I are working on a project right now where the machine room is being rebuilt right now, so we had to pull what machines we needed into the control room. You know, everything had been beautifully wired in the machine room, so we have now temporary wires strung across the floor in the control room. And my place was really clean, like you would never see any wires.
Right. It was totally dialed in.
Yeah. And now it is undialed in.
Temporarily.
Temporarily, and it's going to be great.
Audio impromptu.
Yeah.
Well, if people are curious, there's a couple of pictures that we posted on the Facebook from a couple articles where they took pictures.
Or even if you go to noisyneighbors.com, there's a page there that has pictures of our music and post facilities. And while you're looking at those pictures, you have to just hear the song The Way We Were in your mind, because it don't look like that anymore. But it's going to be great. When it's done,
it's a bummer
in
that
just
was.
9 short years.
It's amazing. Like the places you work, it's just, I can't, you know, set it up right, set it up the right way. It doesn't have to be anything big, but they just become so important to you.
You know what? I will say this. When I first built my current studio, basically, once the construction was done, you know, it came in at about 3 times what we had budgeted, which is about right. But at that point, I didn't have money for furniture. And a lot of wiring at that point, actually. But we had a bunch of temporary wiring, but I just decided to use my old furniture until I could replenish the budgets. And a lot of it was just sort of IKEA tables and things I had from my old studio. And we got by on that for a long time. But then a few years ago, we talked on the podcast about how I got all new furniture
is
custom
it in
built.
Yet? Is it finished?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, they just finished it. That did take a long time. That was a long project. But I purposely made it where every piece of furniture was the right height and the right depth, so I wouldn't find myself reaching ridiculous distances and, you know, having to do a trackball with my wrists too low or too high. It made a huge difference. It was a little awkward because the way the IKEA tables were, none of it was ergonomically right, because a lot of these tables I had on wooden, like, elevator bases and stuff just to get them up above other gear.
Right.
And it wasn't at all right, but I did get used to it. And then when I finally had everything at the right height, like my main controller keyboard is at exactly the grand piano height and all that kind of stuff, it made such a big difference. It took me a while to get used to it, but it was so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm very cautious about things like carpal tunnel and tendonitis and stuff. And part of what I do is I move around a lot in the studio. I tend to try not to sit in one place all day. I'd rather have more workstations spread out. I'm not someone who likes to have a million different programs running on one computer. I'd rather have a lot of computers spread out.
No, that makes sense.
Move around a little.
I think the complete opposite. I think for my studio is I like the cockpit, and I've got actually two studios that are working, one over at SoundLux and one that I've got, and totally two different philosophies. The one at SoundLux I built very much in purpose with no windows. Everyone goes, didn't you want some windows? I'm like, absolutely not. Because one of the things that can't happen, I put so many hours in, I don't want to see the time of day.
Right.
Because especially in the winter, 4 o'clock and what? Oh, it's getting dark out. Yeah. I'm getting tired. Meanwhile, in the summer, it's 8 o'clock. It's still light out, yeah. And I'm going. So it's almost like when I go, the room is got kind of gray and black. And it's something where if you actually look at the walls, your eyes can't focus on the walls. I dim the lights down just enough that you can't really tell the size of the room. You know it's of a certain size, but because your eyes can't focus, it just kind of blends into the shadows.
Right.
And really, when the picture comes up on my big screen, that's all I really want to see. And then I've got 4 to 6 video computer monitors surrounding me now.
Wow.
And everything's in a circle. And there's like a little area for me to walk in. So no matter where I go, where I pivot. And actually, one thing they do have at a key, which is really cool, is they have these steel, they're steel with leather tops. They're kind of like, you know what you write on? What are those called?
Like a desk.
Like a blotter. Like a blotter. But what's great about it is you can move them away from the desk and put your keyboard and move it around.
Hmm.
So some have angles, some have straights. And I've got probably 4 of those.
Wow.
So at different points, I can angle the keyboards around me however I need to work at that point. But I got my outboard gear at, 45 degrees behind me and the keyboards. And it's just something where no matter which way I rotate. Now, the funny thing is, at both studios, they're set up exactly the same. But at home, I didn't want a dark room. Great. I already have the dark room, and that's great. And I really miss the light in a home situation. So then I've got big windows with shutters on them, and the shutters can change my sound a little bit, which is pretty funny. And but it's a much more lighter. It's wood, beautiful wood floors, and it's much more earth tones.
Right.
And it's much prettier.
Right.
Going that way. But it's just different environments for what you want. Yeah.
We're actually going to have to change the vibe of my place a little bit because part of what we're doing in the rebuild is putting in a projector and a screen and that kind of stuff for when we're doing more dubbing work. And my place is like super sunny and bright and I don't even have window treatments. It's just big picture windows so that I can feel like I'm connected to the world while I'm working because I'm down there all the time. But as a result, the place is super bright and sunny. And we've actually worked on like some really dark movies, and the idea of having a director over for a screener in the middle of the day, it's like it's all bright and sunny. You can't really watch a horror movie that way. So we're going to put some window treatments outside that can basically blacken the windows.
Wow.
But if we don't want them, they disappear completely. I don't like seeing curtains in the studio. I like having it just be open. But then when we do want to get it dark, it needs to be able to get completely dark.
You know, that's amazing that you had windows at home because a lot of people, a lot of home studios, a lot of home workspaces that I've seen, the first thing they do is people want light to come in. They want to see the outside.
Well, that was one of the great things about moving home is that now I have two like clerestory windows, way up high, and then I have two like a double French door that opens out onto my patio, and so I sit there. It's like sitting in the forest,
right?
Mixing, it's really nice.
Now, Martin, when we redid Martin, he used to have his control room was inside a windowless studio, and we moved it into what essentially was his family room, and now he has a nice big window, and opens up, and he has a pull out there, and it's just way bright and just a lot of positive energy. So
yeah, I think one of the great things about working at Noisy Neighbors at Rob's place is you've got this whole wall of windows all the way along the studio, and then you've got a double sliding door where you can go out onto the balcony.
Yeah.
And we've had clients where we're doing film mixes, and we've had clients go out there and set up a little table and just sit out there all day, just working.
Yeah, they make their office outside.
Well, it's because it's a gorgeous view and it's very vibey. So
is important.
Vibey.
And also, a lot of that for me was a backlash because for the first, dozens of years I was with Stevie.
Right.
His studio is it's a very old building in in L.A. And it's actually the first recording studio in L.A. There's a lot of history there. It's where Nat King Cole recorded all of his hits.
Really?
They used to do radio shows out of there. Tons of history. But one thing it's not is bright and sunny there. I mean, the walls are like 4 feet thick. It's like, it's like Fort Knox or something.
Yeah.
And so in the morning or whenever we'd leave the studio, we'd push these gigantic lead doors, you know, to get outside. And we would all look at each other before we'd open the doors and say, what do you think it's going to be? Is it day? Is it night? You know, we'd have no idea. And, you know, I did that for decades, and that just got old. And I definitely felt like, not only didn't I feel connected with the world, I mean, we'd open that door, I had no idea what time it was, what day it was, what year it was. It was just so disorienting. And I said, when I do my own place, I just can't have that. And the funny part is, Stevie has a reputation for being on his own crazy schedule, and everybody always thinks that he doesn't know what time it is.
Right.
The truth is, he has a great sense of time. He knows exactly what time it is all the time. He has a watch that can talk to him, and he has one that's like a grandfather clock that chimes for him.
Right.
He doesn't care what time it is because he's not on anybody else's schedule.
Right.
But he always knows. But he was the only one. When we were working at his studio, we would have no clue.
He didn't allow anyone else to wear watches.
We didn't wear watches. Not sure why.
I think my favorite studio
case
though,
charged by the L.
Yeah, exactly.
Was Peter Gabriel's place.
Oh yeah, that's gorgeous.
Where you know you look at the console and you're looking out face at the pond.
At right. The pond. You're halfway.
You're halfway down the pond.
Yeah, I worked on his wave frames a couple times.
And it's just a big room and everything was very organic looking. It's
crazy. Even though it was just a giant concrete, bowl basically.
And his little synth room out in the forest.
Oh, now that
it's like
cool.
A hobbit land.
Yeah, exactly.
You walk in and there's these giant trees and there's this building that looks like it's built into the tree. And it's like an arch top. And then you go on the porch and then all of a sudden there's every synth and guitar pedal you can ever imagine.
That's awesome.
And it's this kind of...
It's like exactly the opposite of the control room of the studio.
It is,
a little hobbit house, whereas the control room is this giant... Look, it could be a spaceship.
Yeah.
And you are literally, when you're standing at the console, at eye level is the water level. So
But the console wraps around you.
Yeah. But you see, you see underwater and you see above water.
That's awesome.
Cool. So are we saying that having millions and millions and millions of dollars actually helps the experience?
Just have one really hit album.
We got to wrap this up because we got to take a break. But I got to ask you guys this because do you remember when you got your first space that wasn't the corner room, you know, or wasn't, you know, your closet was your space? Do you remember the first time when you finished the install, what that feeling was like? Because I do. I remember when I put together West Wave and when I finished putting all the gear and I fired everything up and it all worked. That was absolutely one of the top moments in my life because you have this sense of accomplishment and you have the sense of like you can conquer the world. And literally I must have stayed there. I didn't even do anything. I just stayed inside the room for like another 2 hours, just overwhelmed. Like, well, I got to pay for this, but but I don't know. It was such a great, great feeling. It was awesome. You know, when you're ready to work. I mean, Brandon, you recently probably went through something.
Yeah, this house we moved into a year ago, we found it on Craigslist. 2-bedroom house plus a detached garage that the owner had converted into a recording studio. So with its own little ISO booth and everything, totally soundproofed. And I just got, same thing. I got in there, set everything up. I'm just like, holy crap, this is mine? Like, it was amazing.
It's the best. I mean, I'll never forget that feeling. It's awesome. I mean, Bobby, do you remember when you, your studio?
No.
yours is always changing though, right?
I was lucky enough. The first studios I did were for other people, so I was paid to build for people, so that does help. So I do have the lovely thing and go, oh, this is really great. And I'll sit there and go, man, I wish I could afford this, but you know. I do remember, of course, building my own one. Yes, of course, I remember my one. Of course. I honestly, I think I was most happy when I got my first Mac Plus and I had an M1 and I sat in like the corner of a little apartment in like Benefit Street in Sherman Oaks and I'd like my M1 and my Mac Plus. I'm going, okay.
That's cool.
And I joined the PAN network. Had 1200
boards. Were you using like what, Performer or using Studio Vision?
I was using Performer then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rob, what about you? The first, I'm not talking about the one you're in now, but the
Vision.
First...
I was using Vision. That's what it was.
Oh, Vision was great.
That's your first. Do you,
I would
do
have
you
to say, well, I can honestly say I don't think I've ever finished a studio.
Well, that's true, too.
I mean, seriously, it's just always work in progress. And any studio that I've designed for myself, I've designed with the idea that I'm going to be constantly changing the gear. But I definitely remember in my last place,
right,
which started out, it was a studio in a house. And it started out as the right size studio and the right size house, and over the next 12 years it grew beyond the point of ridiculous, to the point where you couldn't even open the front door all the way because there was so much gear, you'd have to like slide in sideways because the door wouldn't open. But I do remember the first time I was actually able to get signal to pass through the whole chain. It's like I was playing a synth, I was seeing it on, at the time the Waveframe was the workstation. And then hearing it through the speakers, and you know, I could mix and play and sequence, and we were using Sequencer Plus, I think, going way back. And yeah, that is, it's a magic feeling. You kind of feel like I can do anything.
Right.
The trick is, as you have done it longer, now my immediate reaction, because I've been rebuilding my studio, you know, for years and years and years. Whenever I get it working, my really immediate reaction is sort of like chills go down my spine and I say, okay, now how are we going to get the gigs to support this? Because it's fun to build your studio and it's fun to extend your operation. I mean, I'm going to be adding a projector and a screen and a bunch of other gear that for post is going to be very useful. And I've always had the experience that when I extend myself and try to move into the next level like that, it always ends up working out.
Right.
Because I have as much of a commitment to finding the work as I do to playing with the toys. So it all ends up working out. But it's always a little bit nerve-wracking when you go a little more into debt, you add a bunch of stuff to your studio. That's a little bit scary, but generally, you know, you got to have sense. You don't want to build your studio beyond what you actually need if the work isn't going to justify it.
I'll tell you what.
It's a little scary.
Yeah, I'll tell you what was scary for me is along the studio lines. And I don't, maybe Scott, you can relate to this too, since you work for a company, is when I got my own room. The very first time I got a job, I'm the mixer, and now this is my room. And you're sitting in there, and you're just, I'll never forget my first job where I was the mixer, brand new room they just built basically for me because I was coming on as the second mixer, and I'm just thinking, I hope I don't blow it.
Yeah. It's a different kind of pressure because you didn't have to pay to build
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
But you have to justify
you
them
gotta justify it. You got to justify it being there. I mean, Scott, you remember the first time you got your own room?
Yeah, I know this sounds weird. I've only had three rooms in my whole career.
Right.
And the first room was just an office suite that I jammed every piece of gear that wasn't nailed down at the
company. That was the cave.
we used to call it the cave.
Right.
And it got to the point where literally, if there was a piece of gear in the hallway, I went, oh, I wanted one of these. And it would just literally disappear. So anytime anyone would like, where's my gear? They just go to my room. It was always there, hooked up. And I had, you know, I moved all like my home studio. I just had so much gear. At one point, you'd open the door and you couldn't see in because it was surrounded by gear. I was trying to figure out how to suspend gear from the ceiling. And I was really had this concept of a cockpit where, you know, like you have stuff above you and around. And I was trying to do all this stuff. And then finally, I moved into this giant dubbing room, which was downstairs at the time. And that room was actually too big. It's like, kind of reminds me of, you know, this one's too small, that one's too big.
That one was awesome, though. It was so big.
It was so big. I was like, I used to have dreams that, like, this big room with this little guy. And it was, and that's when I started doing the surround thing.
Right.
And then I, again, brought all my gear. And it looked cool. But then I realized that I wanted to go home. And I had two parts of my music side and my post side. And I realized, well, okay, I finished post. And I want to go home. So I can't because the music stuff's there.
Right.
So either I never play the music or I never go home. So that's when I decided, okay, I got to bring the stuff back and divided the two. Then I actually designed the room I'm in now. So I totally designed it with our head of engineering. And it's almost there. I love it to death. It's about 30 feet by 23 feet.
Yeah, it's not small by any means.
No. But, you know, but what's great about it is it's a pretty dead room. Sort of. But what's nice is because it's so big, it has its own kind of acoustic properties.
Right.
And because the speakers, the closest wall that they're near is 10 feet, 8 feet off the wall. So the client is suspending in the middle of the room. And so now I get to hear speakers. Less room, more speakers, except for subs. And now the holy grail for me is, again, is less about the room, because the room has no personality. It's black. I mean, it's black, gray, pepper. You know, the ceilings are sloped. It's dark. It's for a purpose. But now, like, I wanted to rebuild the screen.
Right.
And we've got a THX wall in front.
Right.
But now I'm like, you know, I'd like to spread the speakers out a little wider because they're a little narrow. And now I've been, you know, I've got 3 5.1 setups just because they all have a very distinct sound.
Wow.
So now it's all about trying to find that extra punch. It's hard because you find speakers you really love.
Right.
And you go, God, that's amazing. It just doesn't translate. But God, does this sound great? And then you've got speakers that are pretty sounding, and they translate to everything in the world.
Right.
So you go back and forth between that to figure out, you know, what do the clients want to hear. I just did a gig, can't talk too much about, but I used the giant Genlux.
Right.
Oh my God, that was fun. Oh, the rock the room, and I use, you know, because I've got, what do I got, 5 subs in front. You know, but it's like left, center, right sub, and then 2 LFEs.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, sometimes you just get stuff that you just love the sound. But the question is, when it leaves the room, is it going to sound like that anywhere? And that's always a key.
Well, all that. Well, first of all, your room, though, is awesome. I mean, you say it doesn't have any personality, but your room is cool.
Oh, thanks.
How tall is the ceiling in there?
It's pretty.
Two stories.
Two stories.
It's a two-story. It's a triple cap. What I've got, the cement ceiling's way above.
Right.
Then we've got an acoustic cap above it, so nobody can hear me or I can't hear them. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a drop-down ceiling, which is angled. And everything's angled. Mm-hmm. Even the walls are slightly vertically angled.
You should do an IR of your room.
You know what, actually? What if on a separate note, the room at home, I think is an amazing guitar room. I've got all these guitar amps in it. And because I've got soft ceiling and a hard wood floor, it's amazing on the guitar stuff. It's full sounding, and it's just, I have 3 different amps in there, and I was just thinking, I think I got the coolest, like, amp booth.
That's brilliant.
That's cool. Yeah. You have to do an IR there. Well, hey, listen, we're running long. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about mixing. Mixing in these rooms that we've just described.
Nice segue.
So that beats the last one, right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so we're going to take a break, and we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about studios. And after the break, I was getting mocked relentlessly. So I kind of lost my way. But
All about love. It's all about love.
But we're going to talk a little bit about mixing. You know, we create these spaces to work in. And then what do? We go in there and we start mixing. And the next couple of podcasts, we're going to actually dig a little deeper into mixing. But on this podcast, I wanted to talk about mixing in a big, broad, general sense. And what I mean by broad and general is we're not going to talk this podcast about gear and specific plugins and things like that. What we're going to talk about is the styles of mixing.
I thought you were talking cocktails. I'm leaving. Sorry.
You're martinis.
We're going to talk about mixing.
Well, you know, the thing about mixing is just like there's a bunch of different rooms and a bunch of different way that people, you know, work in their environments, there's a bunch of different styles of mixing. And to be honest, it hasn't always been that way. You know, for a while, you know, there was a time in music history where you were kind of confined to how you mixed by the board that you were on. And you as a mixer had to mix to the board. And before automation, you know, you really had to play the board. And not just one person, but sometimes several people had to work in conjunction with each other to really nail down some of the mixes. And if you listen to some of the great recordings from, you know, the 70s and the 60s, and you listen to some of the mixing that they were doing back then, it's mind-boggling as to how how this dance worked, you know, how, you know, where you had to like, okay, you handle this and you handle that. Okay, here we go. And you make a mistake. Okay, let's go back. Let's start over.
Do it again.
Let's do it again, you know. And think about some of the records. Like, can you imagine Bohemian Rhapsody? I mean, to me, that's like, oh my goodness. Especially since, you know, I got, there's the raw tracks that you can get out there on the internet. And when you listen to the raw tracks and then you listen to the mix and you're like, holy smokes, that must have been a dance. I mean, they must have really been a choreographed dance to mix that thing down, because it was just, it's just amazing. But now, as technology has progressed, we get to the point now where we can kind of control mixing now. We're not necessarily a slave to the gear. We're more of a slave to the DAW, but as you know, controllers have advanced and ways to mix have advanced, there's a lot of different ways to mix. And what I want to know is, how do you mix and why do you mix that way? And what I mean is, like, for myself, I'll start off. I'm a combination. I'm a heavy mouse mixer. I use my mouse. I actually draw in the envelopes of whatever I'm mixing. I will draw the volume, do my own volume graphs manually. And it's mainly because I do a lot of spot mixing. So sometimes I'm working with as few as 8 tracks. And very rarely do I go over, you know, 24 or 32. If I'm doing some branding commercial work, I can go as far as 64 or 100. But it's all pretty containable. And then when I need to pump up the emotion a little bit, I'll ride some faders. And so I'm a combination of mouse mixer and fader mixer. But mainly, I will say, because of my deadlines, I'm a mouse mixer. And so as I see the playback head going, I know I can read the waveforms, and I know how to make adjustments on the waveforms and stay a little bit ahead of the playback head, so that I'm mixing here, but I'm listening maybe 2 seconds behind of where I'm mixing, and that allows me to have the speed, and it allows me to crank out a lot of spots and a lot of times. And so that's why I mouse mix. But then I know there's other guys that are like fader mixers, are you a fader mixer, Bobby?
I am, yeah. I do mouse as well, but not much. Mostly faders.
And why do you fade?
Because basically it's more interactive. I'm an old school guy. I grew up doing what you say, multi-track mixing with hands on. Get the band in, get the producer, get the tape up. We always just sit there and play different parts. It wasn't as hard as you could make mistakes, definitely. But you used to edit stuff there. You used to record a half inch rather, and just chop it. So it wasn't that bad. So I like faders. I like the way they feel better, and also you can a mouse is only one input at a time,
right?
Which is very, very unintuitive for a mixer. And I think it's important to mention what we mix, because I'm talking specifically about pop music mixing.
Yeah.
Multiple tracks. So I'm talking, 48 tracks of audio flying at you with a lot of effects. So it's a little more complicated than just... So you have to have the ability to touch multiple faders at the same time.
I would say a little more different.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you know, when it comes to some of the sort of basic mixing,
right.
It's really unfair to put them in the same category. No, I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, because you've got so much more going on than just like, let's make sure this dialogue's above this background track and that crash comes in there. I mean, it's certainly, that's a skill too. But when you're doing... no, I'm serious.
That's a throwdown.
I've got to be honest. There's no comparison to a pop mixer. You got to kick ass, or a film mixer. You have to kick ass.
You know what? I totally disagree with
go
you.
Go ahead, Jimmy. No, really.
Because, you know, not just spots, but you make, you know, music and mixing is controlling your energy, right? And you have to do the exact same thing when you're mixing spots. Now, granted, not all spots are difficult, but some of the bigger ones, you approach it just like you mix music. You have to worry about frequencies, you know, clashing. You got to worry about things cutting through. You got to worry about noise. You got to worry about edits, and you got to worry about a hell of a lot more edits.
Well, but the thing is, now I mix music, and I mix spots, and I mix film, and I do them in different styles. But I have to agree with Bobby. I think spot mixing, I hate to say it, I think spot mixing is a lot easier. Yeah. Generally, you're working on a 30 or a 60 second piece of something. You're not working on something that's 3 minutes long or 90 minutes long, you know, or a reel that's 20 minutes long, where you've got this whole linear, kind of, you know, thing that you've got to, you know, that's got to hang together.
Well, yes, spot mixing, I will give you that, but like commercial mixing and where you're basically doing, you know, a film in 30 seconds and every waveform matters and the client's hanging on everything. I don't know. There's definitely
there are complicated spots where there's a lot of elements.
On a general spot, I'll give you that.
But don't blink because it'll be over.
Can I make a suggestion? Don't ask me, Mike.
No. I'm not saying that spot mixing is any more difficult than music.
I'm just saying you can
actually use the same approach for all of them.
I think I've mixed all of them in my career, and I think the hard thing with spots is you've got a committee behind you, and you're actually performing with them because you've got to do it within 30 minutes, and if it takes too long, there's a different dynamic. I think there's certain artistic mixing, which might be a little more on the record side.
Yeah, I think so.
Where you could sit there and put 16, 20 hours, and you could take a big two-hour lunch. The hours are your own to sculpt what you want out of it. And on film side, it's different than that. I mean, I'm dealing with 400 to 1,000 tracks.
Right.
So when I hit 48, I'm like, I haven't mixed a 48 track anything in so long. I mean, I'm anywhere between 1 to 12 Pro Tools systems.
Yeah, I know. It's just not
right. How do you mix, by the way?
You know, I actually, it's hybrid. Because I've learned to use as an editor, a computer, there's certain things that I do in Pro Tools with a mouse. And let me explain what I mean. I don't ride volumes at all with a mouse. I have to use a fader. But what I do is if I get a trim, let's say backgrounds or dialogue, there's all section dialogue that's a little too low or too little loud, I'll just highlight it and bring it up 2 dB and I'm done.
Right.
I don't need to do everything in real time to go 2 minutes in. That's a 2 minute section. I don't need to listen to 2 minutes of it. I already know what's going on. I take it, I trim it up. But then let's say I've got music and a lot of times I get 32 to 48 tracks of music. Just music within my big section.
They're stem music, though. It's stem.
Oh, yeah, but I've got, like, ear candy. I've got... sometimes I think it's bass guitar. Sometimes I got guitar.
Right, but you don't have to gate the drums or psych.
No,
right.
And it's stems. They're designed to be played at unit. Unless you decide you need more bass.
That's when they listen to it music only, because I mess with it all the time. First of all, a lot of times I get stereo, so I got to make it 5.1. Then I got to figure out where things are going to go. And then, of course, they've got the musical instrument, the piccolo, or some solo instrument right over dialogue. So then I got to take that and move it around and, you know, and do stuff and echo out the music and over a scene, over a cut, which they didn't do. So a lot of times I'm trying to be more storytelling than just doing music by itself. So I've got at any given time a dozen reverbs. It's not unusual because I got the long one, I got the short one, I got two different ones in dialogue, they go from different rooms. All of a sudden, I'm going to change those perspectives, you know, from inside to outside, if you want to keep it special or virtual. For me, like I've got something called X keys,
right?
Which I love. All my plugins are on X keys. So I've got a mouse, I've got, I actually mix 75% of the times on one fader. And I call it the fat channel because I'm used to the Harrison. So I've got a fader, and then I've got all of my EQs and my compressors. I position myself in front of the center speaker. I don't want a big console because then I'm out of the sweet spot.
Right.
So because my room's not that big. So I always have the small console. In Pro Tools, I call up the number 100, track 149. I call it up. It's right on that fader right in front of me, EQ, compressors. I'm super fast to calling up numbers. I go in, I do a quick little fade, a little spike in it, go to the next number, and literally just fly through all of these tracks based on what I need. Occasionally, I'll spill it out towards all VCAs or all auxes or whatever I'm doing, but very rarely am I doing a 10-finger mix. You know, if I'm bringing everything down, like bring it back down a dB or two, then I'll just highlight it and move the VCA back. You know, non-real time.
Rob?
I mean, I'm going to say two things, one which won't be offensive and one that will.
Oh!
Start with the one that won't.
Okay, Randy.
Well, I'll just tell you first, the way I mix, and Andrew Sheps used to make fun of my mixing, because I didn't start out as a mixer at all. And I don't think for the first few years I realized that faders could be brought down. I would just always make everything louder. And he used to basically tell me I would do the yardstick mix with the smiley face EQ. You know, it was always everything at the same level, but everything louder than everything else, and then tons of bass and tons of treble. So yardstick mix, smiley face EQ. And I've gotten, I've mastered some of the subtleties since then, but that's the way I was mixed. And I used to be purely a mouse mixer. Because I never thought that we could get enough faders when it came to a workstation. I'm not talking about on a console. On a console, I loved being involved with giant SSLs and giant Neves and stuff, but I was never the one mixing. You know, there was always someone else doing that. And in my own studio, I was using waveframes and other systems which would be mouse-based, and I could never get a physical controller big enough to be useful. Now that I have a big D control with Pro Tools and I have enough faders...
Right.
It's a different story. My thing with controllers is I think you either have to have very few, like one or eight at the most, or you have to have, you know, 48 or more, because if you have somewhere in the middle, then you have a really hard time finding the channel you're looking for in a big project.
Right.
It's much easier to scan eight faders to see if the one you need is in front of you. Or it's much easier to have 48 faders and know that it's there. You just have to find the fader.
Right.
The hard part is when you have like 16, like I had a Pro Control with 16 for a long time, and on a 100-track project, I could never... find the faders.
Right, you have to bank up and down too many
banking
times.
Banking constantly would drive me nuts. Now, though, what I find is I generally, in a first pass, and most of what I'm mixing is post stuff, because my partner Gary mixes the music stuff because he's a legendary music mixer and I'm not. But generally what I'll do if I'm mixing post is I'll put the console in like a preview mode and I'll just rough in the faders because it's really fast. You just grab all the faders, put them up, you can hear what's going on. But I find I then do most of the tweaking of the mix by mouse because I'm just so much faster, and I'm faster than anybody doing it with faders because I'm just simply not playing everything. I'm jumping to a place, you know, seeing what that is, see what the level is, fix it.
Yep.
And I'm jumping around, and it just, it's faster.
Yeah, and you are blazing at doing that because Rob and I work together. But the
my personal way.
But the reality is that if you're sitting and doing a film mix with a director, it's hard to do that because
they're not seeing what you're doing.
And they get impatient and they want, yeah.
But you know, one thing we're all forgetting, and it's critical, because I went from D commands and D controls and whatever. I mean, Control 24s. Faders are faders, and I found that that's kind of one level of mixing. But where I found where I'd love the D command, and now I'm starting to train on the Euphonics Series 5, is that knobs.
Absolutely. So I was going
to
say that.
To sit there and mouse over Renaissance EQ or any plugin and watching everything screen and you can't get that smooth sweep, to have a knob and sweep an instrument and go, there's that offending frequency right there, and then dip it. All of a sudden, having it programmable and touch. I mean,
totally.
I'm all over that.
We use that all the time.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that I love coming down to work with Rob is I don't have a Pro Control or a D command or any. You know, I'm a mouse mixer in my studio, and I've mouse mixed since 1988.
Right.
But we, a couple of years ago, we had a film, and the director wanted to mix in L.A., and Rob said, okay, let's just do it at my place. And I came down, and Rob taught me the
D-control.
The D-control.
You learned it fast.
Yeah. And I've never looked back.
I'll tell you one good thing about mouse mixing for me that it's trained me. I can read. I'm really good at reading waveforms. I can see what the sound is going to do, and that.
But try doing that with a fader.
And especially the type of mixing that I do, it's where you can see a lot because some of the track there's not much to it may be 16 tracks and you can see all those, so I can read waveforms really well. And the other thing that I like about mouse mixing is it's you can do moves that you can't do with
absolutely
a fader. and that really kind of add like some like if you need to duck something and bring something up and just
like an S, like let's say if you don't want to use a de-esser and you sit there and put one of those just dips right in on the S, just bring it back 6 dB.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, done. You can't, there's no way to do that with a fader.
Yeah. And the fact that you can just – the cool thing about mouse mixing, too, is you start writing any parameter that you want on any plugin that you want, you know. So whether you're adjusting thresholds and you know, counter pumping against a real pumping piece of music or something. I mean, just stuff that you just never in your wildest dreams
Let me give you a real world question then. Let's just say you're sitting there with your mouse and I'm producing the studio and I'm saying, okay, do us a favor, Mike, take out horn 1 and 2, bring up the hi-hat, and let's take it from bar 3. And you're like, okay, hang on a second. Okay. Click, click. It's just too slow. You've got to be able to go bar 3, 2 tracks down, mute, play.
No.
And it's like, bap, 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 bap.
I agree. I mean, I've got faders in front of me, and I've got mutes, and I've got things like that. And so that's why I'm a hybrid. But right. But I've seen people like, for instance, Martin. Martin's an all mouse mixer. He actually went the other way. He was all fader.
And I love him dearly, but he's the slowest mixer in the world.
But his mixes are pretty damn phenomenal.
They sound good. You know what I'll say? You know, it's mixing with the mouse is sort of akin to instead of buying a piano, you buy one key and a transpose slider.
That's exactly right.
You can make a record that way, but it's going to take a long time.
It's not really just mixing with the mouse. It's mixing without knobs and faders, because you're using key commands and you're highlighting.
A fader is not a fader. I mean, I find as a mixer, it's like I'm a guitar player. I find like the Couture 24 faders, I didn't like the touch of them as much. And there's certain faders if there's a certain amount of resistance, because you got to feel the sound. If it's just too glossy and it moves too well, then you don't feel it. So you want a little resistance. So when you push something, there's a feedback to it. It's a tactile
experience.
What is that?
I didn't say my offensive part.
No, go ahead and offend us first. Offend
first? Yes. Okay, rush.
This won't offend all of us, but it'll offend some of us. You know, I've been involved with, and I've seen a lot of and done a lot of, but more seen a lot of film mixing, spot mixing, and music mixing. And I just have to say, there's nothing else on the scale of film mixing. You know, when you talk about number of tracks and the complexity and trying to carve out spaces for things, there's nothing more complicated than that in the mix world. Spot mixing is more forgiving. There are still people who are great at it and people who are terrible at it. But when it came to mixing, that was the kind of mixing I felt more comfortable starting with, because it's more a matter of, can you hear everything? Is everything coming through? But the subtleties that you'd have on a more complicated mix, a lot of times the clients aren't sophisticated enough to hear that, and they don't have the money or the time to let you do it anyway. So it's a little bit more forgiving. I'm not saying any of these are easy, and they all take a ton of experience, and there are people who are great and people who are terrible. I will say that I don't think there's anything more complex or important than music mixing in the mixing world, and I'll tell you why. Because when you mix a record, you have the chance to be creating something that becomes a part of millions and millions of people's lives that they carry with them, that are something that they trigger memories. I'm not saying films don't, commercials don't, but films do, but nothing is as personal as a song. You know, you can't just in a blink of an eye remember a whole movie. I mean, you can think back about a movie and how it affected your life, and it can hit you emotionally, but it's still not as emotional as a song can be. And also with the song, you're dealing with something that's created usually in a much more haphazard way. I mean, a lot of creative artists will hand a song to a mixer that's a total mess. Most of the time in film, if it's a good film, it's a film of the caliber that Scott's working on, you have professionals putting these tracks together. You don't just have some crazy dialogue editor who just spits out 300 tracks and says, I don't know where anything is, but here, you'll make sense of it. You're a great mixer.
And then we'll name audio.
I totally agree with you, because one of the things, like, I love learning the art forms of everybody else. And I saw Andrew Sheps did a seminar, and I loved it. Because I watched what he did, and I got 1,000 ideas. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that's different with music mixing is music mixing for records is also a little bit of music sound design. Because what's happening is you want to maybe put the backwards reverb on the snare. You might want to add two or three compressors that bring out tone. In film, they're not going after the tone as much. That's really what the sound designers do. Yeah. They're the ones that give, not 100%, but the really good ones. Well, you know, the creature is the creature is the creature. They may add a little sub. They may bring it out with a little reverb, but that's pretty much it. I think that to get that great guitar tone, they might double trip it. You know, they might put delays on it, put a little flange. You might flange the reverb. There's so many tricks that I think the music mixer in records is as much of an artist as the musicians, because they're adding maybe not the notes, but a signature. And sometimes it might be the key signature, which everybody really digs, because it might be a really funky bass part that's really so exotic that it makes the tune. So sometimes that could be done by the musician. Sometimes it's done by the engineer. So I think there's two components to music that's not just quote unquote volume mixing. Right.
So I wasn't offensive enough?
No, you know what? I absolutely 100% agree with what you're saying. I'm not saying, listen, I've mixed them all, right? I've done film. Film is just it's this gigantic, massive landscape that you got to carve this path through, and you have to be you got to make sure you know you don't get too close over here, and you got to push the story through. Mixing music is similar, but it's very emotional. It's to me, it's like if I mix music, it's where my creative juices I feel are just you feel. You know, you're really. It's almost like you and the songwriter. If it's not your stuff, you're coming to the table with your style, with your personality. You have really a lot of creative input.
It's not just making sure you can hear everything.
Right, exactly. Right. And you get to
changing the feel of it. You can change the feel of it. A really good thing for people to listen to is it's on YouTube. It's by the band called 10cc.
Right.
I'm Not in Love. It's called.
Right.
And they actually, there's a whole nice video on there.
I just got it on Spotify.
Oh, that's your song, but that's the way they mix that song.
That is an incredible mix, that song.
That is, and you know how they did it, basically? No idea. It's the equivalent of a Mellotron. What they did was they sang those vocals all by themselves on different tracks, and they only, you know, so they sang one note, they say, okay, let's sing this chord, let's sing this note. So these two make that note, so they would sing in two parts on each track.
Right.
And when they wanted to change chords, they would turn up the faders so that the volumes of the notes would come up.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that's how they did all that.
Well,
and it sounds amazing.
Amazing. But, and how clean is it? I mean, that's analog.
My thing is, and the reason why I was, you know, at the beginning I disagree with Bobby is that I don't want to discount any part of mixing. You should
have. Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely not. No, I respect it all. It's all very hard.
Everything's got their own challenge.
It's all very hard.
And you should approach it, you know, there's this, everyone needs to learn the skill, and they all have to have skill at the highest level to do it properly.
Oh yeah, look, I'm amazed at like TV mixers. They'll mix an hour to 2 hour episode of a show in 3 days, and for the life of me, I can't ever imagine mixing an hour and a half to 2 hours in less than like 2 months.
Right.
Sure. So to sit there and wrangle those amount of tracks so quickly with guys behind you,
right?
I don't know how you do it.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
and it's really hard.
I'll tell you what, it's because I worked, I did a show for Fox, and you're under the gun all the time. I mean, just to get it done. We had 1 day to do the mix. We had 1 day to do the mix, and it was like you start, and you knew by the end of the day you were doing the layback, and producers right behind you. Everybody's having their input, and you got to. Not only do you have to do the mix, but like you said, it's a show. You got to control your room. You got to keep it all lighthearted. You better be happy. You better smile every once in a while. You make sure they're doing okay because, you know, do you need anything? And it's just this
a lot
giant
of that
dance.
Type of mixing, though, is, you know, the physician's credo, you know, do no harm.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so you're not like sculpting. Yeah. You're more like, okay,
be safe.
What
safe
needs
mixing.
Help? What needs help?
Well, yeah, you know what?
Take your battles.
And I will tell you that, and a lot of that kind of mixing too is your editor is your best friend.
Sure.
Because how your editor goes, how it comes to you, is going to determine whether or not you're going to have a good session or not. I mean, and some people, you know, you would think things would be obvious, but I worked on just like 2 months ago, I did this major trailer for a video game that was coming out, and sound design was done elsewhere. And when I got the tracks, the dialogue was spread amongst like 24 tracks, right? And so the dialogue wasn't even on the same track. And the effects were all over the place. And all the impacts weren't on this. I mean, it was just really the guy just... I don't know. It's like he sneezed and it just all landed. and I called him up and I said, dude, you need to...
Gesundheit.
you need to re-prep this for me. And he was going, what? And I go, yeah, I need all the dialogue on the same track. I need you to break the thing out. And he was a music guy, and I guess this is one of his first gigs. Or
he sent you jazz.
Yeah. He did. It was, but it's like, you know, your editor is your best friend, because if he lines it up and everything's there and there's no pops and everything's hitting, and all you have to do is, you know, EQ, like you said, and help it out and make sure, you know, it's all sound smooth, then it makes it possible.
When I'm sound supervising, and I've got a reputation of bringing a lot of tracks, and I know some of my, you know, people I've worked with, other supervisors, they'll hear, hey, Scott came in with like 800 tracks. And they go, man, you're out of control. And I said, I can paralyze any mixer on the planet with 16.
Right, exactly.
The reason why I have 800, they're categorized. Right. So now, there's no, it's so broken out. And the reason I do so many shows that are CG-based, that I'm like, oh, the jet engines of the blah, blah spaceship just changed. I'm just going to change 10 tracks, and I'm done. Yeah. The mix keeps going. We never lose at 1,000 to 1,300 bucks an hour.
Right.
Who's got the time to change, to slow a mix down? Yeah. I'm like, okay, those 10 tracks come offline. We put the new tracks on. It is so easily band-aided and fixed, because they're always changing it through the mix, that the mixers love me when I'm working with other mixers, because it's just so smooth.
Well, and they know where everything is. Oh, there's a jet engine. Right. That must be it. Oh, yeah. They're always here. Yeah.
We need a little more track 12,000.
But it's very, very predictable. And a lot of it's... And one thing I think most people don't realize, that, and it has to say, because I do such big track counts.
Right.
100% of the mixers, not even 99, 100%, are mixing in what they call groupers. So even though we have all of these tracks, they're only mixing on 16 to 32 faders ever.
Right, yeah, of course.
Then if all of a sudden, now one 16 track might be all the weapons.
Right.
Well, the weapons might be 32 tracks wide, but they never go 32. They got here's the guns.
Right.
Here's good guy guns. Here's bad guy guns.
Right.
You build it out. So all of a sudden, it plays so smoothly.
Well, that's good. Essential.
Then all of a sudden, once they find out, and it's predictable from every reel, and if you set it up a certain way, thinking as a mixer, and you do it, then it actually becomes a very easy...
Well, yeah, because you know exactly where things are,
right?
Yeah, and you don't
predictable.
Have, yeah,
and you can change on the fly. If somebody throws a curveball at you, you can.
Well, there's that.
That's what you've got to be.
And
able
you
to do.
Generally, you're not going to go into the 48, you know, weapons tracks. But if there's one gun there that you need, then you got to go look for it.
And that's one of my favorite things about the D control. You just spill out those groups. Yeah. So if you just do have the one weapons fader, but you need to get in there, you hit one button and it spills out.
You know, when you said that, because I was thinking, because I'm starting to train, like I said, on the Euphonics, and that's a whole different piece, because then you've got 16 master faders and, I don't know, 48 or 64 individual faders that go all the way to, you know, across town.
Right.
And but then it's great, because what I like, not that you ever use them, you spill them out and you can see exactly what you got going.
Right.
So then it becomes a visual aid. And then if there's like, oh, hey, the sub's down a little bit. Let me kick this up. Pop that up a little bit. Give a little thump to the room. And then keep going.
You know, it's great that you say that, because there's nothing, as a mixer, there is nothing worse than when you're trying to mix something and your editor doesn't cut for perspective. And you got to adjust, you know, 12 tracks, 13 tracks, even, you know,
they don't
come
for perspective, you send it back.
or you know, actually, though, you talk about the mouse.
Right.
That's the perfect time.
Yeah.
You highlight that little scene, and you just drop it down 6 dB.
But it just totally breaks your flow. But that's actually the good thing about, you know, working on a DAW with automated plugins, because, you know what? You don't have to necessarily, if you have it, you know, augs out right, boom, just change your setting if you want to do it on your EQ, and boom, your perspective just changes. But still, it's kind of a pain in the butt.
I think I'll say...
Go ahead.
I was going to say just one more thing since I started off. on a bad step with Mike. I think a person that does music mixing would be a better student for all other styles of mixing. I think is a great grounding for.
I agree.
I came from that background too. And not only that, but if you can always tell the good post mixers because they have that music background, because it's all music, it's all sound, it all has to flow. If you can lower the volume so you can't really understand what's going on and just kind of get the vibe of the mix, you can kind of tell, you know, if your mix is there, if it sounds like a nothing spiky, nothing's popping, everything's nice and smooth, like a good song. I still love you and I agree with you. Hey Brandon, what kind of a mixer are you? Because Brandon, he's all the way on another genre. He's doing all these musical sound effects and all these big musical beds for trailers. And how do you approach that? What's your musical?
I'm definitely a mouse mixer. One little trick I use all the time. In Ableton, you can highlight as many tracks as you want. And then when those are all highlighted, if you move the fader on one, it's going to move the fader on all of them.
Right.
So like instant grouping, sort of?
Yeah. I mean, and you can group as well. You can throw things. Grouping is super easy. But I put, there's a utility control. It's just a volume control and does a few other things as well that I'll slap on top of in my chain on each track. So I'm not really doing any volume edits on the faders. I'll keep those in case I want to bring the entire mix down at the end. And so I keep those free, use these little volume things on each track and go that way. So then, yeah, if I'm jumping into the red on the master, I can just...
Right.
And it's super easy.
Hez, what about you? How do you...
Well, I started out on a 64-channel Neve with flying faders in grad school. That was my first exposure at all, so I got really spoiled.
And it was all downhill from there.
it was kind of a funny story real quick. The guy invited me up there, showed me the studio, and I was in awe, and he said, here's the key. And he walked out. And, you know, he didn't quit, but he was like, I need somebody else to sit here and figure it out. So I was very lucky that I got to do that for... a semester. Then I came out here and had nothing. And I've spent the last 16 years trying to get back onto a 64 channel Neve, but I haven't been able to buy one yet. So I'm all mouse, but I do use like a Novation SL Mark II. Right. It's got the rotary controls and it's got the faders on it. And I sign those all the time. I work with 8 channels only at a time. I work standing up now because of ergonomic issues. Oh, I built my own stand.
That's amazing, really.
I know a lot of guys are starting to stand work up. Standing up.
Yeah, I've got
don't
a mat.
Don't your feet get tired?
I got the mat. I've got a work mat like you have in a shop, in a machine shop. And also, because what was happening is I had a great chair, and the back and the neck were fine, but I always put my feet up on the legs. And I usually work without shoes on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden I feel my toes start tingling and it's the balls of my feet the balls of my feet would start tingling. And it's because I was like tendonitis in the balls of my feet. So I would just ride that all the time and be working and everything. And my back was fine because I was always kind of sitting up because these were sort of elevating the rest of me, but they were wedged against the pad.
Wow.
So I work standing up, and I'm definitely a mouse guy, and it's for all the same reasons that you guys have talked about with, you know, getting in there with the waveform, seeing it, you know, for what it is, you know, being able to sort of write it, post changes and just kind of, you know, almost like super real time.
With mouse mixing too, though, it's you don't have to. If you're a mouse mixer, it's not that you're anti-fader because I can take my mouse and I can grab a virtual fader and I'm riding the music like I would be riding a real fader.
I oftentimes just work with one fader and one rotary knob.
Yeah, so it's kind of the best of both worlds. Although having said that, when you work on a fader as opposed to the mouse, there's just something cool about grabbing a fader.
I'm playing an instrument.
Yeah, I will say because working on a D command, I've got 32 faders, and when I'm in a situation where it's appropriate to do it, you kind of feel, you know, you feel just a little cooler.
Well, you feel more like a mixer.
Yeah. I have to give it to you. Even though I'm total, I'm a pro mouse mixer. I love mouse mixing. I love the fact, I like when you're so into a mix, not only can you read your waveforms, but you can read your volume graphs. You know, like a lot of times I have like a third mixer that I have to approve his mixes and stuff, like, you know, when they go out, and I can look at his mix, and I can see where he's going to have some problems, because you look at the volume automation and you realize that it's going down, and then you see the little waveform where the VO is supposed to be, and you go, hey, right there, you're losing a ton of energy right there, you know. And so it's just, there's something really cool when you're that intimate with
something. I like using the fader and watching the line. You know, hitting the fader, the line turns red. Right. You know,
and you see where you're going.
You see where you're going, where you're coming from.
My favorite console, though, bar none, I think, in the post, is the Harris. Well, I like the Euphonics for a lot of great things that it does. But there's a couple features in the digital Harrison console that is unbelievable. One of them is every fader has a vertical waveform right above it. So let's say you got a piece of dialogue, because what I use waveforms for all the time is when to dip music.
Right.
Also, exactly. I'm looking at the dialogue at all times. I got the music up, dialogue's coming, then I got to start bringing it back a little bit to make room for it. And all of a sudden, every fader, so if you have 64 faders, they all have 64 waveforms that go with however you're going to switch the faders around. The other coolest thing they have is comparative meters. So let's say you've got your, whether it's stems or pre-dubs or whatever, you're recording onto. All of a sudden, if your meters turn yellow, it means something's not matching. So it's comparing your playback and your input. And if they don't exactly match, all of a sudden, the that channel starts turning yellow.
That's kind
of
cool.
And then you sit there and you go, wait a minute. Oh, hey, one of the Pro Tools stop locking up. It just stopped.
Right.
And this way, especially when you're running so many Pro Tools like we do,
right,
there's never a point where you'll go, oh, one of them came offline. I wonder how long that's been that way. Because you can go half a day and go, oh, shit. You know? So all of a sudden you look at the meters and everyone's like, boop, hey, that just turned yellow. Okay, now let me look through it and say, okay.
That's cool. Rob, were you going
to? I was just going to say what Brandon was talking about points to a really good trick for mixers like myself who do some fader and some mouse. And what that is like in Pro Tools, in my case, we'll always put a trim plug in at the top of each channel. And if there are crazy rides that need, or crazy moves that have to be done with level, it's much easier to do them with the mouse, and you do them with the trim plug in. And what that does is it frees up the fader for the big moves, right, or for the big gradual moves.
Yep.
So like if you have a bunch of dialogue and there's one syllable that's really soft, it's easier to just go into the trim, bring it up, and never have to worry about it again. But you don't want to see your fader like jumping for one syllable for no reason. It's nice to know once I fix that syllable, I stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
And
do you use VCAs at all?
Yeah, we use VCAs.
I'll tell you one cool thing about mouse mixing is when you get into heavy duty, hardcore mouse mixing and you have really tight time schedules, you think of some really cool things. Like I have what I call the 5-minute mix template, right? If there's a spot and they forgot about it and it's going to air that night and they need to hit the satellite or whatever, I have this little template that literally pretty much mixes itself using sidechains, compression, and limiting, and then automating my my threshold on the sidechain. And it was just developed by basically reading waveforms and being able to sculpt around to find the perfect little range of where you want to hit the sidechain. And I've heard about yours.
We
also have that.
We call ours the Cuisinart. Yeah, because literally, you put anything into it, as long as you put in the dialogue where it's supposed to go and everything else where it's supposed to go, it'll Cuisinart a mix out for you. Yeah. And it may not be the greatest mix ever, exactly, but you can hear the dialogue.
That's the thing. It's like with this, the music will always pop in where nothing else is there. So you always have it. It's going to be a smooth pop too. It's not going to be like, hey, ho, hey, ho, you know. Yeah. And then
Use Waves Easy Writer?
No, I developed this before that. But
I used it once on a film.
How did it work? Okay, never mind.
But like Rob was saying, if you can nail your dialogue right, if you can get your dialogue and you get your compression right, so that your dialogue stays at a pretty good norm, and maybe just go through and take some of the plosives out, you know, manually as it's going down. And then you use your side chains with that for like your narration, your dialogue, and you let your side chains, you know, take control of your music and then your effects. You can
ride your thresholds and
you play it back and you just make, you know, big changes and you're like, okay, here you go, and you just, okay, that one's not going on my website. But anyhow, well, hey, listen, we've gone way too long, but you know, this is a good start. You know, we're gonna keep this up talking about mixing, and we're going to get into some even more details. But as you can tell, there's a lot of different ways to mix. What have we learned on today's podcast? That Bobby hates me, and that Rob's a snob.
You know it, baby. Wow. I'm proud of it.
No, actually, what we learned is I think the most important thing is, obviously, when you are mixing, everybody's going to develop their own style. The main thing is, you know, whatever you need to do to get the job done, but also, you know, however you feel connected to whatever project you're working on, you know, whatever way it is, sometimes you're limited to not having the giant desk, but you know, you can pick up little faders if you want to try faders. And also, you know, I want to challenge you to go out there and do something. If you're a mouse mixer, you know, grab a fader. They have, you know, cheap little MIDI faders now that, you know, and try incorporating that. Because I will tell you, faders definitely add an emotional element to the mixing that you can't get. And, you know, so...
That's maybe what they invented faders before they invented mouse.
Funny about that.
You know, I'm trying to make peace with you. Anyhow, before we go, Rob, can you talk about anything?
A lot of construction, and also Michael and I are working on, well, there's no secret, we've worked on a bunch of Google stuff in the past, and working on some now. Can't talk about what it is yet, but it's still, they're a fun company to work with.
Nice. And Michael, how about...
I'm still working on my, I think the last time I was here, I started cutting picture and sound and mixing for a live concert of the Curtis Salgado Blues Band. Which also has Taj Mahal and the Phantom Blues Band on it.
Wow.
And it also has Robert Cray Band on it, and it also has the Steve Miller Band on it, and it also has, believe it or not, Everclear on it.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was like this benefit concert.
Wow.
So it's, you know, 9 hours of chaos. And
sounds like our podcast.
So that's been kind of fun. Cutting picture and Final Cut, and then going over to Pro Tools.
Final Cut stick.
Well, not at my studio.
Let's not start that. That's a whole other 30 minutes. Rob, your comedy has been on tonight,
yeah,
man.
Really?
Rob's back.
Apparently drywall dust is good for him. Maybe there's vitamins in drywall dust. I'll let you know.
That's pretty more than there is in a cheeseburger.
I spent the last week and a half mixing for a producer down my way. And it's funny, we were talking about musical mixing and everything like that. And it's the first real heavy project that I've actually been able to work on. And I got the nicest compliment I think you could probably get based on what we've been talking about, which was when I finally finished it, he said, "Don't touch it. Don't touch it.
Nice.
I've got to go play this for somebody." And I was like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah, the vocals are perfect. They're perfect." And I was like, "Wow, I'm really bad at vocals. This is great," you know? So I got really excited, and we're starting to work on a bunch of other stuff. So
nice.
So that's cool. And then other than that, I'm actually working on a couple of remix projects of my own.
Cool.
You know, just spending a lot of time standing up in my studio late at night. And that leads me to one more thing real quick. Something that's not obvious about wearing headphones. A lot of people mix with headphones now who can't afford to have the speakers or have them on late at night if they don't have a real studio. And it actually causes a lot of sinus problems because it's dead air in the ear, and the inner ear actually, the bacteria in your ear needs air, or I should say your ears need air in order to be able to counteract the bacteria that lives in there. So when you have headphones on for a long time, it deadens the air in there. You're not getting the airflow. And so that stuff goes into your eustachian tubes, and you get headaches and all that. So everybody out there, you know, I went through this whole last week because I was literally on headphones for a long, long time.
Wow.
and it got really sick, actually. So you got to watch that. And it's not because of the headphones themselves. It's because of the lack of air.
You know what? It just goes to show you that mixing will kill you.
Yes. I was going to say, I think we may be the frailest seven people I've ever met.
Brandon, how has mixing killed you?
I'm still hanging in there. This is all good advice for the future. What am I working on? We've got this kids movie called with The Rock called Journey to Mystery Island, which is
cool.
Kind of goofy, but it's got, you know, a lot of big creature, you know, everything's larger on the island. Right. So you've got giant insects and spiders and stuff, which has been fun. So
cool.
Yeah.
Scott.
Hello.
How about you?
Wow, what have I been up to? Well, I've had a lot of family issues this summer.
Right.
But what I've done is I've kind of gotten back to my first day back, actually. But I'm starting, like I said, training on the Series 5 Euphonics consoles because I'm starting to get a little demand to maybe supervise sound design and maybe see it through the whole process.
Hmm.
And so I'm starting to learn the rooms over at some of our facilities and see where that takes it.
Nice. That's awesome. Bobby.
I'm not doing anything, dear sir. I'm just finished building my little ergonomic setup. Matter of fact, I'm going to finish off most of it tomorrow, the next day, and I'm writing a couple of demos with some people, and I'm in the middle of this sample library, which should be coming out. NAMM. Yeah, I would say
really?
NAMM. Yeah, looking good for NAMM.
Wow, that's cool.
I'll also say that a while ago we had some of our. Friends on the podcast who were NASA scientists right. and worked in that right. community.
Yeah.
And they actually have a big launch coming up. I'm not sure when this podcast is going to
it'll be up and
be live.
By the end of the month.
By the end of August. So early in September, they're going to be launching a mission called Grail, mm-hmm. which is very exciting. It's a lot of people who were on the podcast before are involved with that. I think Scott is going to go check out the launch. I'm thinking of it.
I'm grabbing 8 mics.
Yeah.
And 4 recorders.
Very cool.
That's
and
awesome.
We're going to...
if you can get to Cape Canaveral.
You know,
never mind.
Yeah, we're working out the whole details, but yeah,
that is awesome. You know what? We're gonna talk about that in a podcast, because yeah. that...
It's going to be pretty cool. Awesome. We've had some of those scientists on the podcast, yeah, so no, that's pretty cool.
And sound design, it's the serious swing.
Yeah, and...
Big time, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know what? I don't want to ask you now, because then we're going to drop another half hour, but... We'll come back and visit that, because you're going to be – there's some SPLs that those things can pump out that
– We're starting to do tests right now and figuring out what can handle that.
Yeah.
See, we know a lot right now how to do this, because we actually know a lot of how not to do this.
Okay.
So don't
say
4
more. Miles.
And I'm still on the fence about whether I'm going to be able to get there or not, but
it'll be fantastic.
Sounds like it would be really
cool. I've got a feeling we'll see Scott after that with his eyebrows.
I got contact mics on the rocket. You
know? Just keep going back.
With a little zoom recorder. You know, just goes all the way up, comes back down.
Each forehead coming down on a parachute.
Do you think I get an endorsement then?
That's funny.
Couldn't you Velcro like a tape assistant to the thing?
I'll just ride it with a boom ball. Go! You know?
That's funny.
The Dr. Strange love.
That's good. You're going to have to fill us in on that. And,
hopefully there's no hurricane.
Yes.
Which is our biggest concern right now.
Are you going to get it from the ground up, or are you going to get it up? You don't know yet, do you?
It'll be from the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, air, how high?
Are you not going to be able to go past?
No, the tower gets toasted.
Oh, I got mics that will, you know, at any volume, any distance.
Okay.
That's but awesome. No, you don't... You can only get to record it from below because the tower that it's attached
gets
completely munched.
And we will continue this on another podcast.
Oh, yes, we can talk an hour about that, yeah.
All right, well, that's cool. Well, that's good. I'm glad your system's up and
thank you, buddy.
Up and running. Looking forward to...
Don't forget, music mixing.
I'm not anti-music mixing. before we go, a couple things.
Mike, what are you doing?
You know, stuff I can't talk about. Oh, I will say that last week I got interviewed for a magazine and photo shoot for a magazine that'll be coming out that I'm not going to say until it comes out.
Wow.
But yeah. But it's a tech mag, so that was
cool. Oh, nice. We thought it was a mail mag.
You're funny.
With a big microphone.
You can't win.
I can't win. Bobby,
you sure you want me back?
Yes.
Just put this one out of its misery already.
All right. Well, hey, listen, a couple things. I called up, I emailed Andrew, and I said, hey, Andrew, we're going to talk about mixing. Can you make it? And Andrew couldn't make it tonight because he was recording the Chili Peppers, who were playing over at the Roxy.
Oh.
And I told him, you know, that's no excuse.
Exactly.
But I mean, so I gotta brag on that. He's out there
working.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not exactly.
He's out there working, which is pretty cool. But you know, when he's available, he'll come back. Especially when we're talking about mixing. The other thing too is we do have a winner for the Bobby Osinski book.
Oh, cool.
But I gotta wait till Bobby's here.
Of course, where's Bobby today?
Bobby's working in the studio. He's working, and he'll be back because we've got some really cool things we want to talk to him. We're going to be tackling the copyright issue on a future podcast, and we're going to get him and some other songwriters together so that we can discuss the whole copyright thing that we won't talk about right now. And finally, before we go, we need to thank Jeremy. I always forget to thank Jeremy.
We can't forget to thank Jeremy.
And Jeremy
is asleep.
Jeremy is the producer of the podcast, and he records the podcast, and he edits them every week. So, Jeremy, this one's for you, brother. Yay! All right.
And this was a good one, Jeremy. You should have recorded it.
All right. Well, you know what? Thank you, everybody, for showing up. And if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Or you can post on our Facebook site, facebook.com/audionowcast. All right. For myself and all the guys, I'm sorry this one's so long. We'll see you next time.
To the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.